Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Kurt Vonnegut was born in Indianapolis in 1922 to a family of architects and hardware merchants. He left for college, Cornell, when he was 17, famously went to war, World War II, with Germany, was taken prisoner at the Battle of the Bulge, saw the Allied bombing of Dresden and its toll. Told us of that in novel Slaughterhouse-Five and much more. Now Indianapolis is paying homage to a native son and one of the 20th century's most bracing writers and moral voices. This hour on Point, remembering Kurt Vonnegut. We'll go to Indianapolis in a moment, and we will hear today from two great younger writers who themselves pay homage to Vonnegut. Rick Moody and Jonathan Safran Foer will be with us. And you can join the conversation. Did Kurt Vonnegut leave his stamp on you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Listener of a certain age, maybe many ages at this point, will know Kurt Vonnegut, perhaps some from his movies. Here's just a bit from the 1972 movie Slaughterhouse-Five. American Billy Pilgrim arrives at a prisoner of war camp in Dresden, Germany, after being captured in the war. Here the camp director informs prisoners where they are.
Schlachthof 5. This is Schlachthof 5. 5 is English 5. Schlacht is slaughter. Hof is house. Schlachthof 5. Slaughterhouse 5.
And soon enough, there would be slaughter in this scene from the trailer of the film. A doctor tells his assisting nurse about protagonist Billy Pilgrim, played by Michael Sacks. Pilgrim lies on a medical table, ready to receive electroshock therapy.
The patient was a prisoner of war in Dresden when it was bombed. He claims that well over 100,000 people were burned to death in the fire, worse than Hiroshima. And since Billy was actually there, it's natural enough to assume that this has had a contributing effect on his present condition.
He's ready, Doctor.
You're going to sleep now, Billy.
You're going to sleep now, Billy, but Kurt Vonnegut was all about waking up. Here he is himself in 1970, reading from an early version of his novel Breakfast of Champions, 3 years before its publication. In the book's open, Vonnegut introduces us to Dwayne Hoover, the protagonist and narrator. This was recorded at the 92nd Street Y in New York City.
I am the only creature in the entire universe who has free will. I am the only creature who has to figure out what to do next and why. Everybody else is a robot. I am pooped. I wish I were a robot, too. It is perfectly exhausting having to reason all the time in a universe I never made. The experiment with me began on the planet Earth. All around me were machines who appeared to be thinking and planning and worrying as much as I was. But they were no more reasonable than the Pontiac automobiles I used to sell.
Everybody else is a robot. A younger Kurt Vonnegut there in 1970, reading from Breakfast of Champions. We're going to look at that and much more in this hour. Joining me now from Indianapolis, Indiana, is Julia Whitehead. She's the moving force behind and now the executive director and president of the new Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library, which will officially open its doors to the public in January. Julia Whitehead, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's just terrific to have you. And from Bossier City, Louisiana, William Rodney Allen is with us, professor of English at the Louisiana School for Math, Sciences, and the Arts, board member of the new Memorial Library in Indianapolis, and author of Understanding Kurt Vonnegut, editor of Conversations with Kurt Vonnegut. Rodney Allen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to join you and Julia.
Julia, we're going to get into what got you into the business of opening a Vonnegut Museum, but you focused right in on a little section of his first novel, Cat's Cradle, where he really goes into Indiana and Hoosiers and maybe human nature, and he takes us right up to a real Vonnegut signature, the Grand Falloon. It's a little long, but we'd love to hear it. It's got Hoosier all over it. Would you read it for us, Julia?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so we join in the story where the main character has met this couple, the Crosbys, and Mrs. Crosby is a Hoosier, and she's a little nutty. So it begins, "You can't go anywhere a Hoosier hasn't made his mark," she said. The man who wrote Ben-Hur was a Hoosier, and James Whitcomb Riley. "Are you from Indiana, too?" I asked her husband. "Nope, I'm a Prairie Stater, land of Lincoln, as they say." "As far as that goes," said Hazel triumphantly, "Lincoln was a Hoosier, too. He grew up in Spencer County." "Sure," I said. "I don't know what it is about Hoosiers," said Hazel, "but they sure got something. If somebody was to make a list, they'd be amazed." "That's true," I said. She grasped me firmly by the arm. "We Hoosiers got to stick together." "Right. You call me Mom." "What?" "Whenever I meet a young Hoosier, I tell them, you call me Mom." "Uh-huh." "Let me hear you say it," she urged. "Mom?" She smiled and let go of my arm. Some piece of clockwork had completed its cycle. My calling Hazel Mom had shut it off, and now Hazel was rewinding it for the next Hoosier to come along. Hazel's obsession with Hoosiers around the world was a textbook example of a false caress, of a seeming team that was meaningless in terms of the ways God gets things done, a textbook example of what Bokonan calls a grand falloon. Other examples of grand falloons are the Communist Party, the Daughters of the American Revolution, the General Electric Company, the International Order of Odd Fellows, and any nation, anytime, anywhere. As Bokonan invites us to sing along with him, if you wish to study a grand falloon, just remove the skin of a toy balloon.
Julia Whitehead reading there from Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle. If you wish to study a grand falloon, just remove the skin of a toy balloon. Rodney Allen reading that, and Julia chose it, but it hardly sounds like, I don't know, Hoosier or anything else was a team that Kurt Vonnegut was quick to jump onto. You're on the board here. He left when he was 17. I don't know how much Indiana stuck with him over the years. What do you think of the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library being in Indianapolis, Rodney?
Well, I think it's a perfect place for it to be, and there's no doubt that Indiana stuck with Vonnegut in the same way that Ireland stuck, with the great James Joyce.
Kurt Vonnegut as the James Joyce of Indianapolis?
I think there's some similarities. Joyce left Ireland and never went back, but just about everything he wrote was, about Ireland. And while Vonnegut wasn't, that constrained, he certainly used Indianapolis as a sort of love-hate relationship. He definitely poked fun at Hoosiers and the sort of provincial, even tribal nature of some of the people in the state, or people anywhere really.
Anywhere.
But he also really, really said that he was a Midwesterner all his life, and despite some of the more radical or controversial things he said, he said he was really a Midwesterner at heart.
Kurt Vonnegut had wild fans all his life. We're hearing from a lot of them online already, and I'll share some of that. But for those who may not have had the pleasure, how do you describe Kurt Vonnegut and his stamp, his importance, Rodney?
Well, it's hard to really overestimate it. I think Vonnegut rode quite a roller coaster during his life, from obscurity to incredible fame around 1971, 72, mm-hmm. especially when the film version of Slaughterhouse-Five came out. It's been translated into over 50 languages, and he's even higher in reputation among Europeans than he is here. Huge number of fans in Germany and Russia. He's friends with the great novelist Günter Grass, German author of The Tin Drum. And Grass once told him, Vonnegut said to me that he did, that, I won the Nobel, but Kurt, I think you really deserve it. his stamp is on American culture and world culture, and I think his reputation will only grow. And that's the reason that I'm very proud to be associated with this library in Indianapolis. I went to work with Julia.
A great humor, a kind of dark humor, sometimes veering right towards science fiction, though you say not that in the end. A strong moral vision, an acerbic moral vision, with that big head of hair and bushy mustache. Julia, a lot of people saw a 20th century Mark Twain in Kurt Vonnegut.
Sure. Yeah, he his sense of humor, I think, appeals to all of the fans that I have met and who contact us. And I think the fact that he liked to think of himself as a regular guy, and he, you know, he would often write about kind of your average working person who is faced with some type of absurdity in life, and I think people can relate to that. And I also think the zaniness of books like Breakfast of Champions, you know, I think that's fun for readers. And then there, of course, is the history related to Slaughterhouse-Five and Mother Night. I know that was very powerful for me when I first read Slaughterhouse-Five. And, you know, I learned quite a bit from that book. I saw the war differently. And I think that was helpful at a time when service members were coming back and did not want to talk about their experiences. And I know it took him many years to actually to write that book and to publish that book. But we're all fortunate for that.
We'll talk about what's actually in your memorial library. You've got a Nazi sword there, a Purple Heart that he made light of. Nevertheless, his typewriter sitting there, and of course, the experiences that he took out of Indianapolis, I guess his mother's suicide, just months before he was off at the Battle of the Bulge and then a prisoner of war and into the whole Dresden scene that we saw in Slaughterhouse-Five, and not only there. We're really looking forward to this. We're going to hear in this hour from Jonathan Safran Foer and Rick Moody, much younger writers with a big stamp of Kurt Vonnegut in the middle of their work as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the biting humor and big ideas of Kurt Vonnegut as the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library opens in his hometown, Indianapolis. Julia Whitehead is with us from Indianapolis. She's the moving force behind the whole thing. Lots of volunteers involved now, and it's all officially opening up just next month. Rodney Allen is with us from Bossier City, Louisiana, author of Understanding Kurt Vonnegut, editor of Conversations with Kurt Vonnegut. We're going to hear in this hour from Jonathan Safran Foer and Rick Moody, two younger writers who have carried a lot of Vonnegut with them as they've plunged into their work and careers. Julia, tell us just a little about the museum. It's in an office building. We're not talking a presidential library here. It's got some modesty about its dimensions. But what's going to be in it?
Sure. It's yes, it is. It is small. It's about 1,100 square feet, but it is sitting in a very beautiful historic building in Indianapolis, and we have the ground floor of a corner, lots of windows. It's the public can see as they walk in our art gallery that features Vonnegut art, and we currently have two pieces of art that were created by Morley Safer, and he is an
60 Minutes reporter, big fan of Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, and he is an honorary member of our board, and he's been very helpful for us in many ways. And so we're happy to display his art that was actually created for Vonnegut on his birthday and then on the day of his death. We also have a museum room that will feature a Dresden display. We currently have the items that you previously mentioned, the Purple Heart that Vonnegut earned during World War II, the Nazi sword.
That he picked up, I guess, and brought home from Germany.
Yes, mm-hmm. And his military insignia. And these items have been donated to us by three of his children, Mark, Edie, and Nanny Vonnegut. And they've just also been extremely helpful to us getting this going. There is a wonderful piece of art that is nearly 20 feet wide that was actually created by an artist in Louisiana named Chris King. And he collaborated with Rodney Allen on that. Rodney came up with the text and the concept. And it's a timeline of Vonnegut's life. And it's spectacular. And it definitely draws the attention of our visitors. We've had a preview event where we've had the public in, and everyone loves that. We also have a display of the Vonnegut family history here in Indianapolis. And there's a reading room, the library part. It's not exactly a presidential library, as you mentioned, but that's the feel of it that we were trying to create, not just a reading room, but all of these other aspects to the library. But we do have the reading room that all the books were donated to us by Half Price Books. And we are, happy to allow members of our organization to check out a book. And we have a gift shop.
You've got everything going on. You know what I love is that you've just picked up and done it. And that is that's quite a beautiful thing in itself. Julia, stand by for just a moment, if you would, and Rodney Allen. Jonathan Safran Foer joins us right now from New York, author of Everything is Illuminated, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Eating Animals, his new book, published just this month, is Tree of Codes. Jonathan Safran Foer, welcome back to On Point. Very good to have you with us.
Hi, happy to be back.
Talk about Kurt Vonnegut for a minute and what he's meant to you. What do you think he's meant to literature in this country?
I think there are writers who create a lot of readers, and there are writers who create a lot of writers. And Vonnegut was both, actually. I know anecdotally, of many, many people who first started enjoying books when they read Vonnegut. Mm-hmm. And I also know of many writers, and I would include myself, who started to get glimpses of what was possible when they read Vonnegut in a way that they might not have with the other books that they were assigned in high school. I mean, one thing that hasn't been mentioned yet is that no one doesn't read Vonnegut at some point. He shares that with Twain, and he shares that mm-hmm. with Salinger. You can't really get out of high school without encountering his work. And when I did, there was something about the recklessness of it that I found very, very appealing as a reader, and also, beginning to think about, as high school students do, what I might do, what I might make, mm-hmm. what kind of stamp I might want to be creating. So, we become convinced that we have to choose that between opposites, comedy and tragedy, or playfulness and a kind of moral urgency, or high and low, and he just blows all of that up and does everything at once, and it's a reason to love him.
Or choose between cubicle and, writer's room. I mean, here he was. He struggled along himself, or looking like, I guess, Rodney in a way for a while, working in Schenectady for GE. I'm reading here on Wikipedia, I don't know, but that he was involved with the first Saab dealership in America in Barnstable, Massachusetts. I don't know about that.
Actually, when, yes. I think it was the second Saab dealership.
Okay. When did he know that he had it in him to sort of show that what's possible to generations that would follow him, or just to get into it here? Now he's got Jonathan Safran Foer. We'll hear from Rick Moody in a moment. But when did Kurt Vonnegut realize that, he had this story to tell and the talent to tell it?
Well, surprisingly, I heard from Edie Vonnegut, his older daughter, as well as the rest of the board of directors, just on November the 11th of this past month. Mm-hmm. She shared a couple of letters between Kurt and Jane Cox Vonnegut, his soon wife-to-be, when he was, 22 years old or something. And he spoke very eloquently in those letters of having the sense that he was going to do something important as a writer. And if she would be his partner in all this, and she had artistic, motivations herself, that he thought that there was nothing they couldn't do together.
Jonathan Safran Foer, you spoke of him showing you, maybe others as well, what's possible, recklessness, an appealing recklessness as part of that. What else? Where else did he push the boundaries in a way that signaled to you, maybe others, you can go here?
Well, I mean, he wasn't necessarily the first to do some of these things, but he gained the widest audience, throwing sequences out of order, throwing chronologies out of order. Mm-hmm. The idea that a book doesn't have to follow one character from the beginning of some kind of quest to the end, but can become fragmented and can become disorganized in the way that life is fragmented and disorganized. It's a kind of relief from structure. And I think it's, a lot of the things that make Vonnegut Vonnegut are why he has elicited such polarizing responses. You know, he's not a canonical figure in the way that Twain or Salinger are. He's somebody who still, I think, doesn't get the respect that he actually deserves.
Roddy, what do you think makes Vonnegut Vonnegut when you look at his work, his way of thinking, his way of looking at the world? What is it?
Well, it's an anthropological perspective. It's something that has transcended Hoosier worship. It's transcended any particular religion. It's transcended the old art that Jonathan was just talking about. And it realizes that people have many more similarities than differences, and that you can also bring a cosmic perspective to the doings, the little doings of man on Earth. And they do seem humorous and puny when compared to cosmic time. And so Vonnegut has the big picture, and yet he also has what every good writer has to do. He can bring you down to that little detail, such as the fellow prisoner who picks up the little bit of Dresden china to take back to his wife, and the SS guys see him, and you know, five minutes later he's been executed for looting. So he'll take you to the very edge of the cosmos, and then he'll bring you down to the most human little details, and do it all at once, as Jonathan said.
Jonathan Safran-Foer, take us back to Slaughterhouse-Five a little bit. I mean, you've written in about wartime experience and the marks that it leaves, and everything is illuminated about what a giant acts of terror and extremely loud and incredibly close. Here was Vonnegut, an actual prisoner of war, surviving the massive bombing of Dresden in an underground spot that kept him safe, came out and saw all these bodies. He goes on to write Slaughterhouse-Five. What did you see this mind processing out of that experience, Jonathan?
Well, one of the beautiful things about the book is how it articulates the inability to process. You know, and that's part of the recklessness that I was speaking about, part of the simultaneous high-low comic, tragic, playful, and urgent, is that I think it reflects the kind of madness of these experiences. And when reading it, you experience that madness as well. You know, one thing about Vonnegut's books is that you can't really be a passive recipient of them. It's very hard to be indifferent to the experience. You get swept up in it. You become somehow complicit in it. And you know, the kind of books that you want to like throw across the room, or make you want to jump up and down, or call someone and read excerpts from them. Not simply because they're good, but because they do in some way reflect this consciousness. Now, I've never had the experiences that he had, but he has a way of eliciting really tremendous empathy. I mean, I think at least as much as any other writer in the century.
And warning us maybe of empathy at the same time. He said of Mother Night, he said, "We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be." Here's just a little bit from the 1996 movie version of Mother Night. Nick Nolte plays Howard Campbell, an American writer recruited to be a spy for the U.S. during World War II, finds that after his service he's unable to convince people that he wasn't actually a Nazi sympathizer. Here's a scene from the trailer where the Berlin police chief, played by Norman Rodway, is talking to Campbell. The spies come to symbolize something about Nazism to the chief of police of Berlin.
Even if you weren't a spy, you could never have served the enemy as well as you served us. All the ideals that make me proud of being a Nazi, they came not from Hitler, not from Goebbels, but from you.
We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be, said Kurt Vonnegut of Mother Night. Let's go to our listeners. Melody in New Haven, Connecticut. Melody, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I actually only graduated from high school last year, and during my sophomore year, I overheard some of my college friends talking about Vonnegut, and I got very interested in him. I dove into his books. He immediately became one of my favorite authors before we had been required to read him for high school, and I ended up writing my high school term paper about him, but it was for my history class, not my English class. So I had to take kind of a different viewpoint, and it was a really interesting journey to look at him from that sort of a perspective.
What caught you, Melody, about Vonnegut? What, you know, you and many, many others around that age pick it up and read it and can't stop. Why?
You know, I think that it's everything that your guest has been saying is, I think, very true. He's so universal. His style is very simple, which I think is, it's very difficult to write like he does. And how he just brings all sorts of different themes together, and how he writes from experience, but at the same time has that very science fiction-y sort of aspect to it, and it's kind of very fantastic while also being very down to earth.
Did he make you a rebel, Melody? He's got a kind of question authority attitude woven all over the place. Did it make you question what was around you?
I think so. I was kind of already on that path, but I definitely think that he, you know, perpetuated that, and that's probably another reason why he fits so well into my life.
Melody, I'm really glad for your call. One more right here. Jorg from Columbia, South Carolina. Jorg, you're on the air. Hello, Jorg. Are you there, my friend? Let's get one from Norfolk, Virginia. Bill, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Kurt Vonnegut has always been a profoundly moving writer for me. I think that's largely because he writes about the deep conflicts within the human mind and the choices that those conflicts force you to make. And what sort of choices you make determine what person you're going to become. And I think the choices that he made in his own life have made him sort of a personal hero to me. The fact that when his sister died of cancer, he adopted her 3 children. That is a very human, very loving, brotherly sort of thing to do. And I don't know if I could do that, but it is certainly an ideal to strive for.
Bill, I love it, and I appreciate your call. That's definitely part of his personal history, and, yeah, it's a stand-up act. I want to get one more. Jorg is back with us from Columbia. Jorg, you're on the air as well. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Sorry about that. I just wanted to share an anecdote. I was 16 years old in Frankfurt, Germany for the summer, and I was befriended by a used bookstore owner who turned me on at the same time to Vonnegut and Sartre. And suffice to say, my life has been very different ever since. But
easier or harder, Jorg, as you absorb the Vonnegut view?
Between the two, yes, infinitely more complicated. I'm forced to definitely think about being alive every day.
That's about as good as it gets. Jonathan Safran Foer, how about it? Here, you know, Melody picked him up in high school. Jorg picks him up, and it's, yeah, it made him think about being alive every day, what it means, what he's going to do with that, and it hasn't made life easier, in fact.
Well, you know, I don't know that that's Vonnegut's responsibility.
No. It's not all about being easier, is it?
No. Happiness doesn't really make people happy in the long run. But what the caller was saying about the sort of moral component to his life and his writing is interesting and true, and also really does distinguish him, not speaking now about his writing only, from a lot of the other great writers of the century. I mean, he was so explicit about it. It's almost embarrassing now, you know, in our heightenedly cynical age of Facebook and Twitter and trying not to say what you actually mean, that... Mm-hmm. You know, he said, I think, God, what was it, the first line of one of his books, I can't remember which, where he addresses babies of the world, you know, sort of welcome to the world, and basically the end of the sentence is the only thing that's important is kindness. And he was very frank about that, and it's whether it's good or bad is for readers to decide, but it's startling and really distinguishes him.
It's straightforward, and I don't know how it can be bad. Kindness is pretty important. Jonathan Safran Foer's new book, Tree of Codes, is out this month. Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the biting humor and big ideas of Kurt Vonnegut. As the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library opens in his hometown, where he lived until he was 17, Indianapolis, Indiana, the executive director of the Memorial, Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library there. Julia Whitehead joins us from Indianapolis. Rodney Allen is with us from Bossier City, Louisiana, author of Understanding Kurt Vonnegut and Conversations with Kurt Vonnegut. We're going to hear in just a moment from Rick Moody, who has dedicated his new book, The Four Fingers of Death, to Kurt Vonnegut. Lots of comments online on Facebook here. Favorite Vonnegut quotes and thoughts. Thomas points to And So It Goes. Dakota says, all persons living and dead are purely coincidental. What Dakota picks up from Kurt Vonnegut. James is thinking about his self-proclaimed suicide by cigarette. Yeah, sad maybe, but what a way with words, he says. Curtis quotes him saying, the only proof needed for the existence of God is music. Of course, his relationship with God was not a simple one. The humanist Vonnegut right out there. Rebecca says, I think he said something like the number one killer in America isn't heart disease, it's loneliness. Here's Vonnegut himself. He got pretty crusty as he went on. This is October 2005, talking with David Brancaccio for Now with Bill Moyers, talking about the George W. Bush administration.
Well, yes, it doesn't know anything about military science. Doesn't know anything about science, you know, global warming, they just don't believe it. And my Lord, is to send 143,000 soldiers or whatever it is to occupy a country of, what, several million? Is that, what, it's 7 million, you think? It's preposterous. I knew better than that, although the highest rank I ever held was corporal. So these people don't know anything about anything. They're incompetent.
Kurt Vonnegut in 2005. Rick Moody joins us in just a moment. A couple callers first. Randy in Cheshire, Connecticut. Randy, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. That last piece ties in with what I wanted to say because I heard Kurt Vonnegut speak twice. Mm-hmm. And both times he said something about American history and our political process, and it really struck me. And the quote was, American democracy was not born in 1776. It was conceived, and some of us have been trying to abort it ever since.
Abort it?
Okay. Yeah, he basically said, you know, that there was not true democracy because of slavery and then because of denial of women's rights and denial of civil rights and gay rights. And he said, we haven't yet come to having it been born. It was just conceived in 1776, and it's a continual struggle.
Randy, I appreciate your call. Julia, I wonder how that goes down in Indianapolis. He was you describe him as a patriot. I mean, you come to this from a background yourself in the Marines. At the same time, he could be pretty tough on his country. He was interviewed in 2003 and started right off saying, I'm mad about being old and I'm mad about being American. Apart from that, I'm okay. How's this sort of testy, in-your-face Vonnegut go down in Indianapolis these days, Julia?
I think in the past, I know in the past it didn't go down very well, years ago. But I think now it's a different story. I think that Indianapolis is much more progressive than it was in the 70s when Vonnegut was writing about it at times. And, I just think that people are more aware and educated and follow current events and at least I have that hope because we certainly have been receiving, so much support from our city, from several of the large foundations in our city. It really does seem that the city is embracing him as a native son. And, and even if people don't agree with everything that he thought, I think they feel proud that he is from here and he had the courage to express his feelings about the way things should be. And I think it's good.
He's a challenging and terrific native son, I got to say. Here's one more from Lubomir. Lubomir writes, I know it may be trivial, I doubt that, but he says, my favorite quote is from Cat's Cradle. And then he quotes at a little length here, Kurt Vonnegut writing, if I were a younger man, I would write a history of human stupidity, and I would climb to the top of Mount McCabe and lie down on my back with my history for a pillow, and I would take from the ground some of the blue-white poison that makes statues of men, and I would make a statue of myself, lying on my back, grinning horribly, and thumbing my nose at you-know-who. And I guess that's God above. Rick Moody joins us right now from New York City, the terrific author of The Garden State, The Ice Storm, The Diviners. His new book, The Four Fingers of Death, is dedicated to Kurt Vonnegut. Rick Moody, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What's the Vonnegut magic, Rick, and why have you devoted your new book to him?
I guess that I'm like a lot of your listeners in that I encountered him at a certain point in my own development as a reader, and I was much changed by that encounter. I think I was probably in middle school in the early 70s when I somehow stumbled on Cat's Cradle, and I kind of came at it from a science fiction angle. I think I was reading Heinlein and Asimov and stuff like that at the same time. And somehow I read this book, which emerges from something like a science fiction idiom, but utterly transforms it and goes to some completely other place. And I was so inspired by this encounter that I then went and read everything that was available by Vonnegut at that time and became quite a sort of single-minded maniac about his work.
But it's not really as though you, Rick Moody, have picked up his style exactly, or his surreal, almost into science fiction element. So there's something else that travels with you. Did he give you a sense of freedom?
I think so. I mean, what seems really important to me now is that his style is completely coherent and very American. I mean, to me, he has this plain spoken style that comes out of Twain and Swift and S.J. Perlman and Thurber and writers like that. He sounds like a person, and a very warm, interesting, complicated person, not like a literary voice. And I find that really admirable. And though I don't ape that style at all, I do aspire to having the kind of warmth and complexity that he brought to what he did. And it seems to me, the uppermost reason that I dedicated my book to him was that it seems to me that the literary establishment in the United States wasn't always quick to realize how great he was. He had a huge popular following, much deserved, but the literary establishment sometimes, especially in his later life, didn't give him as much respect as he truly, truly deserved. So I wanted to try to help rectify that a little bit if I could.
That's pretty great. And what do you think about Indianapolis kind of organically, maybe in the stead of that establishment, coming up with its own little library for Vonnegut with his mementos?
I think everything that happens to Kurt's legacy at this point is really important, because it's the 10 years after a writer passes away that his reputation sort of solidifies, and sometimes that's for good and sometimes for ill. I hear that the Vonnegut family is not entirely happy with the library in Indianapolis, but what's important in the end, I think, is that those of us who feel strongly about his work continue to try to raise our voices in praise.
Julia, is that right? I know any number of Vonneguts have been involved with what you're up to. Are people on board or not?
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, we have three of his children from his first wife, Jane.
Three of the seven that claim him, right?
Yes, yes. And they are on our board of directors. They're very involved. They came out to Indianapolis last month, and they're showing great support for us. We could not do this without them. Even the local Vonneguts who were from, let's see, how do I want to say this? They didn't necessarily like his works, you know, years and years ago, but they rally around the Vonnegut family. They're very proud of him, and, you know, we've managed to pull the family together in a way, I think, that they, they have not been for many years. As far as people who prefer not to remain or not to get involved with us, we're always happy to accept any member of his family who would like to participate. But we did hear from, you know, the three children on our board and the attorney for his estate and his artistic collaborator, Joe Petro, that, you know, they strongly feel like this library should be in Indianapolis. And, I have to believe that, too.
Rick Moody, when you were sitting, it's so great to have you with us, when you were sitting with your new book, The Four Fingers of Death, and you're deciding to put that dedication down, if you could voice the message to, I don't know, the country or to Kurt Vonnegut behind that dedication, what would it be?
Just that this is a body of work, Vonnegut's work, that deserves attention and is among the really singular accomplishments of 20th century American fiction. And it arrived at a time when fiction was really changing. And I think, which is to say the sort of experimental writing period of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and I think that it was consonant with those changes that were taking place and was very slyly premeditated and mercurial in ways that are fascinating. So for me, Vonnegut was sort of a gateway to work that is really unusual and really challenging, and that's what I found so valuable about him as a reader. And if I could, what I would do would be to sort of summon us all together, all the fervent readers of America, and say again, you may think that this was a you know, warm, fuzzy, popular humorist from the 70s, but you're really missing out on a very innovative body of work, and it deserves your renewed interest and enthusiasm.
Rick Moody rallying for Vonnegut in the canon. Rick Moody, author of Garden State, The Ice Storm, The Diviners, and his new book, just out, The Four Fingers of Death, dedicated to Kurt Vonnegut. Rick, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Trevor in Gloucester, Virginia. Trevor, you're on the air.
Hi. I out of all of the quotes that are easily accessible by Vonnegut, I think probably the easiest one, somebody online said earlier, which was his And So It Goes. And also right after that, in the very beginning of Slaughterhouse-Five, and the birds go pooty wheat, which I find myself saying both of those at least 100 times a day.
And so it goes. Thanks, Trevor. One more. Roberta, Waltham, Massachusetts. Roberta, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have two comments. One is a reflection of my teenage self. When I was a teenager in the 60s, I was completely crazy about Kurt Vonnegut, the way you might be about the Beatles. Mm-hmm. I found out that a distant cousin had known him at the Iowa Writers Workshop. At that time, Slaughterhouse hadn't come out yet. God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater was out of print,
mm-hmm.
and I lamented this to this distant relative, and shortly after that, an envelope arrived at my home with the return address, Vonnegut, Barnstable, Massachusetts, and it was a signed copy of that out-of-print
book. Wow,
which is a treasure that I've carried around with me for years.
Yeah.
I would also like to say two other things. One is that my son, who's now a college student, when he was about the same age, he read Cat's Cradle on his own, and he became enthralled the same way I was without me selling it to him, and I don't know which quote, but he used a Vonnegut quote for his yearbook quote.
Our time is short, Roberta. What about your adult sense of Kurt Vonnegut?
Yeah, I'm a psychologist, and I recently reread Slaughterhouse-Five, and I think it is one of the most compelling, I don't even know what other words to say, comprehensive portrayals of PTSD that I've ever come across, even in clinical literature. And I'm particularly struck by the way he deconstructs time and how that deconstruction of time, the past existing in the present being meaningless without the past being part of it and so on, I think that is exactly the experience of traumatized people, not just war veterans. And it struck me in such a profound way. When the book originally came out, I was so excited because I knew it was a book he had always wanted to write, and it felt as if many of his other books were leading up to it. But when I read it again as an adult, I had this other sense of it, and a new appreciation.
Roberta, I appreciate your call. Rodney, our time is short. You've got a reading. If we go straight into it, we might make it. It gives a strong sense of Kurt Vonnegut, why people love him and why some may hesitate. Can you read us a little bit from Slaughterhouse-Five there?
Sure. This is right after Billy is in a plane crash and he's recuperating. While Billy Pilgrim was in the hospital after his plane crash, Elliot Rosewater, who was in the next bed, told him about a novel by Kilgore Trout called The Gospel from Outer Space. It was about a visitor from outer space who came to Earth and made a serious study of Christianity to learn, if he could, why Christians found it so easy to be cruel. The alien concluded that at least part of the trouble was slipshod storytelling in the New Testament. He supposed that the intent of the Gospels was to teach people, among other things, to be merciful, even to the lowest of the low. But the Gospels actually taught this: before you kill somebody, make absolutely sure he isn't well connected.
Wow, wow, that's Vonnegut. Rodney Allen reading there from Slaughterhouse-Five. Is that going to be up on the wall in Indianapolis? Is Indianapolis ready even now for that, Julia?
Yes, it absolutely is. And we hope that everyone will come out January 29th and attend our opening day events, and then we'll have regular hours following that. But yeah, we hope to have everything the public would like to see, and we ask for the public to go to our website, VonnegutLibrary.org, and make comments and tell us what you want.
Well, I'm sure they'll do it. We've also got a gallery of images from your new library at our website, onpointradio.org. Julia Whitehead, I'm impressed that you've just pulled this straight up by the bootstraps and made it happen. Wish you very good luck with it, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, and may I say thanks to Katz and Corin Law Firm for giving us the space for free to have this Vonnegut Library.
Hats off to them. The Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library in Indianapolis, and Rodney Allen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you for having this program. I think it's been great.
We'll go out with a little memorial somebody put up on YouTube, little Billy Joel. You'll hear Vonnegut right in the middle. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And you can have this heart to break.
I have a message for future generations, and that is, please accept our apologies. And so